Stand with me as we read Daniel 4. Daniel 4, starting in verse 28. All this happened to King Nebuchadnezzar. 12 months later, as the king was walking on the roof of a royal palace of Babylon, he said, "Is not this the great Babylon I have built as the royal residence by my mighty power and for the glory of my majesty?" Even as the words were on his lips, a voice came from heaven. "This is what is decreed for you, King Nebuchadnezzar. Your royal authority has been taken away from you. You will be driven away from the people and will live with the wild animals. You will eat grass like the ox. 7 times will pass by for you until you acknowledge that the Most High is sovereign over all kingdoms on earth and gives them to anyone he wishes." Immediately, what had been said about Nebuchadnezzar was fulfilled. He was driven away from people and ate grass like the ox. His body was drenched with the dew of heaven until his hair grew like the feathers of an eagle and his nails like the claws of a bird. At the end of that time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes toward heaven and my sanity was restored. Then I praised the Most High. I honored and glorified him who lives forever. His dominion is an eternal dominion, his kingdom from generation to generation. All the peoples of the earth are regarded as nothing. He does as he pleases with the power of heaven and the peoples of the earth. No one can hold back his hand or say to him, "What have you done?" At the same time that my sanity was restored, my honor and splendor were returned to me for the glory of my kingdom. My advisors and nobles sought me out, and I was restored to my throne and became even greater than before. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and exalt and glorify the King of heaven because everything he does is right and all his ways are just. And those who walk in pride, he is able to humble. Have a seat. Here's the thing. Anybody ever gone and gotten a passport before or just gone and gotten a passport photo before? Well, it's a lot like going to the DMV. And maybe you can all understand that when you have to go to the DMV, it's something we don't want to do. It's like a root canal, but we know we have to do it. When we know we have to do it, a sort of despair comes over us in the process. And as we're there, in whatever case, we notice ourselves being frustrated. We notice ourselves getting infuriated. And we start having these questions of why. Why is this taking so long? What is happening? And I don't know about how you react to these situations, but I can tell you how I react. The reason I can tell you how I react is it was just a couple months ago. And I'm going to tell you actually 2 instances, but this one these both happened a couple of months ago. But in both instances, it has my reaction to something. The first one was me walking into a CVS store right over here to get a passport photo renewed. All I needed was a passport photo. Remember, just a passport photo. I was the only one in the store at the time. And the sweet girl behind the counter said, "Well, this is easy. Let's go take it." So I go walk 10 steps to get a passport photo. She takes my picture, on which, by the way, it was a digital camera. I haven't really seen a digital camera in a long time, have you? But on a digital camera, took my picture on a digital camera, walked it over to the computer, plugged it in, and that's when everything went crazy. As I was sitting there on a stool waiting for her to print my photo, 30 minutes elapsed. Because other people came into the store. She needed to go back into the storeroom. She needed to go get the manager. And by this time, I'm not sitting on the stool anymore. By this time, I'm now walking, pacing in front of the counter. You know, just to remind her I was there. Because all I needed was a passport photo. A passport photo. 35 minutes later, and after I reminded her time and time again that I was there first, she finally got my photo to me. Smiling, apologizing, and being as kind as possible. A couple days later, my wife got in a little fender bender. Everyone knows what happens when you get in a fender bender, right? Everyone knows what happens. You got to call the insurance. Well, started calling the insurance, started talking to the insurance adjusters, trying to get things figured out. And with any kind of fender bender, you never know what the decision's going to be. And well, it turns out the decision didn't fall the way I wanted it to fall. So I got on the phone with the insurance adjuster because I believed that I could tell the insurance adjuster how he needed to think. Why? Because while I'm on the phone with him, I'm reminding him of the vast degrees that I have. I don't know why, but something came over me. Something came over me, and I had to remind him that not only do I have an undergraduate degree, but I have two master's degrees. Not only do I have master's degrees, I'm getting a doctorate degree. I mean, why I'm telling him all this, I don't know, but I'm getting mad. And in the 10 minutes that I talked to him, I reminded his place that he's a guy sitting next to a computer in a call room, and I slammed the phone down because I showed him. It seems to be what happens to a lot of us, does it not? Seems to be what happens to a lot of us, especially in a world that is focused on individualism, a world that is focused on success, a world that is focused on telling you that you're better than everyone else, that you're better than the person on the phone, that you're better than the sweet lady behind the CVS counter. And I'll get back to them in a minute. Because you see, in both these situations, my superiority oozed out of me. I mean, if I could, you could tell that I thought that I was better than everyone in the room at CVS, and I was definitely on the phone reminding this guy how much better I was than him. And in doing all this, I felt good about myself. I felt vindicated about myself. I felt like I knew what I was talking about. And that's the thing about all this that the world tries to get us. In a world that feels crazy, in a world that is telling us that you're better than everyone else. And the best quote I found to kind of tell you what this dream looks like came from the movie Aladdin. The reason I use the movie Aladdin is because it seems to be the Franz family's favorite movie right now. Live version or cartoon version, we're watching at least both of them every day. But the cartoon version, Jafar says this to Aladdin. You've heard of the golden rule, haven't you? Whoever has the gold makes the rules. Now, somehow, in a world that feels flipped on its head, that's the golden rule. That golden rule trumps the golden rule of Matthew 7:12. It trumps the golden rule in which Jesus tells his disciples, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind. And also what? Love your neighbor as yourself. Jafar's golden rule seems to even trump that. And so when we read Daniel 4, we're going to be a bit startled because as it starts out, Nebuchadnezzar is announcing in chapter 4, verse 1, announcing a royal proclamation to the entire people of Babylon. Something has happened to him. And in hindsight, he wants to give the people an important message. And isn't that the beauty of hindsight? We always learn after the fact. And here's the thing. As he's writing, as one commentator says, he wrote to tell the citizens about something God had done for him, or perhaps, more accurately, in the context, something God had done to him. Because, you see, verse 4 and 5 tells us this. It says, as Nebuchadnezzar is writing, I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at home in my palace, contented and prosperous. I had a dream that made me afraid. And as I was lying in bed, the images and visions that passed through my mind terrified me. Now, if we know anything from chapter 2, we should know this. That when a king has a sleepless night, something's going to happen. When a king has a dream or a nightmare, something's going to happen. And in this dream of Daniel 4, once again, Daniel is called on to interpret the dream. And as Nebuchadnezzar begins to tell the dream to Daniel, we begin to notice the first part of the dream. The first part of the dream, as he says in verse 10, is that he sees this tree, 10 through 12, he sees this tree and it's prosperous. And as he says, it's at the center of the earth. And to know anything about a tree in the ancient Near East is to know this, that a tree was a common image for the shelter and sustenance provided by a great king, reigning as the representative of God and mediating life, provision, and protection of his people. So as Nebuchadnezzar has this dream, and Daniel will interpret it, Daniel will say, the first part is about you. You are the tree. You are this great and mighty tree. You are prosperous. But we notice something is, as he has this dream, and it's great. Sounds like a dream. Look how great I am. Look how wonderful I am. I'm better than everyone else. I'm making everyone prosperous. The dream changes a bit in verse 13 and 14. The dream changes a little bit, and this is what Daniel says. He says, in the visions, or this is what Nebuchadnezzar says to Daniel, in the visions I saw while lying in bed, I looked, and there before me was a holy one. a messenger coming down from heaven. He called in a loud voice, "Cut down the tree, trim off its branches, strip off its leaves, and scatter its fruit. Let the animals flee from under it and the birds from its branches." The dream of greatness that Nebuchadnezzar just had, this dream of look how prosperous I am, is now becoming a nightmare. The tree is cut down. The tree becomes, as he says later, like the animals. And so we might be able to see why Nebuchadnezzar wants this dream interpreted. It goes from good to bad rather quickly. It goes from being mighty to being nothing. It goes from touching heaven to now becoming lowly with the animals. And so as Daniel hears the dream, he must interpret the dream. And we also notice that as he hears the dream and has to interpret the dream, in verse 19, it tells us that Daniel becomes distraught as he hears it. Daniel begins to be worried as he has to interpret it because he knows, I think, what has to be said to the king. And here's the thing about ancient Near East is, we always notice this, the dream is always interpreted no matter what could happen. Because by most royal laws, the dream had to be interpreted. And you weren't punished for the interpretation. So you spoke the truth. You spoke the interpretation. And you couldn't be punished by the interpretation. What you could be punished for is if you just decided not to interpret it at all. So Daniel had to interpret the dream. And even as the dream got worse, Daniel knows that he has to interpret this dream. And when we read, we notice something in Daniel's interpretation. He says this. He says, the end of verse 19, "My Lord, may the dream be for those who hate you, and its interpretation for your enemies." My Lord, may the dream be for those who hate you, and its interpretation for your enemies. Daniel's response is fascinating here. You would think as Daniel's hearing this and he knows the interpretation, he might be getting a little bit giddy. I mean, how many times have you not gotten a little giddy when someone you thought got exactly what they deserved, got exactly what they deserved? Honest, you didn't kind of chuckle and go, they got exactly what they deserved. We notice something here, though. Daniel doesn't act that way. Daniel's distraught. Daniel actually says, "I hope this isn't about you, King," although he knows it is. "I hope this isn't about you." Maybe, as we see in Daniel, the golden rule is still something to live out as a disciple. Maybe Jesus' teachings on loving your neighbor is still important. Maybe loving your neighbor even means loving our enemies. Even to the one who burned down the house in Israel. Even to the one who took out the capital of Israel. Daniel does not embody the life we notice in this one verse. Daniel does not embody the life of, "I am better than you, King. I know more than you, King." Instead, he embodies a life of humility. Especially as he begins the interpretation. And as he ends the interpretation in verse 27. In verse 27, Daniel says this. As he finishes his reading, he says, "Therefore, your majesty, be pleased to accept my advice." I want to give you counsel now, is what he's saying. And the counsel kind of surprises us. "Renounce your sins by doing what is right, and your wickedness by being kind to the oppressed. It may be that then your prosperity will continue." Daniel's counsel is, become benevolent, Nebuchadnezzar. Reach out to the people who you haven't reached out to. You aren't better than the lowliest citizens, even though you may think it. Instead, O king, I will keep telling you, love your neighbor. Even for a king on earth, you must care for those around you. Yet the reading keeps going, and in the text we just read, we notice that Nebuchadnezzar can't humble himself, that he lives into the golden rule of Jafar and not the golden rule of God, that as Nebuchadnezzar looks around his rooftop, he says this in verse 29 and 30, "It is good to be king." He looks around, and we can't help but notice what he says. 12 months after the dream, it's amazing how quick we forget, does it not? 12 months after, as the king was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon, he says, and notice what he says here. Is not this the great Babylon I have built as the royal residence by my mighty power and for the glory of my majesty? Humility hasn't really gotten into Nebuchadnezzar very far. He seems to still believe that those who have the gold make the rules. And in the flip of a switch, we hear the voice of heaven cry out, and Nebuchadnezzar is made like one of the lowliest creatures. Because you see, in Nebuchadnezzar's mind, 12 months later, he's thinking this: I command the greatest armies, who can defeat me? I command the greatest economic power, who can take that away from me? I control the lives of people. Remember Daniel 3 from last week. I get to decide who lives and who dies. Who could show me otherwise? Because you see, what Nebuchadnezzar is living out is a golden rule that says, this is what power is. This is what control looks like. The golden rule that we know of Jesus has now been trumped by a golden rule of the world that says, you have and you attain as much gold as possible, and in doing that, you will have all the power, you will have all the control, you will get to tell people that you are better than them. Because that's what we're all trying to do. We're all trying to get that status, that we're better than them. I can do it better. I can do it faster. I can do more efficiently than the other person. And you may even have a tendency like me of telling that person you can do it better than them. I mean, it's common in the way we think. I mean, I can't get over this, but it seems common that we all want to think that I'm better than the next person. And when something isn't going my way, or when something is taking a bit longer than it should, when I didn't get the answer I wanted, I remind them somehow I'm better than you. Who tells a guy on the phone you have 3 degrees? Whether it's the person helping you with the passport or it's the insurance adjuster on the other line, when we believe we're better than them, in all likelihood, we're going to let them know it. We are. There's no reason to do it, but we do it. And in the last year, as I've been looking back and preparing for Daniel, these two instances have continued to stand out. And like Nebuchadnezzar, I don't think I'm learning from them just yet. And it's amazing what this sentiment can do. It's amazing what this golden rule that I used with Jafar, but this idea in our minds, this Nebuchadnezzar idea that I'm better than you, isn't it amazing how this idea can change us from one person to another? The person I talked to, the lady at CVS, or the person I talked to on the phone, was not me, but it was me. It's not a person I would recognize, but it was me. It was an ugly form of me. It was a distorted image of me because I was so wrapped up in myself that I could not believe that another person may be there. I was so into myself that I couldn't imagine it. And I am not the only one immune to this. All of us in here sitting now probably have had those moments in which you've done the same thing. And all those moments in which you've done it, and when you're done, you go, I don't know who that person was. We've all done it. Why? Because in this kind of world that seems flipped on its head, it is trying to get us to continue to be formed and conform to this attitude of I am better than you. And it's only in hindsight, notice Nebuchadnezzar's words, it's only in hindsight that you begin to realize what you did and how you acted. It's only in hindsight, when you sit down to do the damage report from the encounter, and you realize what you said and how you said it. When you sit with someone else, as you regale your tale of superiority, as I sit down with my wife or a friend and say, let me tell you what happened and what I said, and as you regale your tale of superiority, they have a way of telling you about your inferiority. They have a way of saying, so tell me about those words of Jesus again. And you go from being here to being down here. And it doesn't feel good. It didn't feel good for Nebuchadnezzar. I mean, who likes to be king and then go with eating with the animals? But you see, we need Daniels in our life. We need people who can interpret the experience for us, who can interpret the prosperity that we have of, look how great I am. We need the people who can say, but look how you acted. Look what you said. Look who you hurt. There's collateral damage all around, and you didn't notice it because you said, look how great I am. You see, we need Daniels, but we also need to be Daniels in a world which is trying to get us to live into the mentality of Jafar's golden rule. And each of us may desire to be Daniel, but if we're really self-reflective, we might just see that most of us might be living as Nebuchadnezzar. And that's a hard thing to realize, that most of us may be Nebuchadnezzar more than we're Daniel. It might even be that we want to live as Daniel. And we might be living as Daniel, but we may have those slight moments of Nebuchadnezzar in us as well. And what I mean by that is we want to be a truth teller. But do we delight in seeing others get their just desserts? Do we delight in seeing others get what they deserve? We want to be a truth teller if it means the person next to us gets what they want, gets what they deserve. But can we be a truth teller like Daniel? A truth teller that we find a way to tell the truth to them about what they did and how they've acted, but we don't do it in a way that makes us better than them? That makes us look better than them. That doesn't look like we're giddy that something bad is happening to them. But maybe we can be the kind of disciple who realizes even as we're telling a truth, we can do it in grace and love. When Jesus is speaking to the rich ruler, and the rich ruler, it's the mark path, it's the mark encounter. When the rich ruler is not getting it, we have this moment in which Jesus, I think, realizes that he's not getting it. And as he's telling him the truth, you got to give up your stuff. But it says this. It says, Jesus looked at him and loved him. I wonder what it would look like for us to be able to tell the truth, be a Daniel, but be able to do it with love. Tell the truth in love, with empathy, with sincerity, with the eyes of God. I wonder what that looks like. I wonder what that would be. In a world that craves power and desires for you to crave power, notice this. The disciples will crave something differently. The disciple will reflect a different desire, a desire of the one that we confess. And as Wendy Wider says it, and she says it best, as she says it, she says this, we're going to reflect the image of the Son by dignifying God's image bearers no matter their offense. And we notice this in this passage, that we don't celebrate, we lament, we pray, we empathize, and we hope for mercy. Daniel did the same thing with Nebuchadnezzar. I hope for mercy. O king, be good to your neighbors. Take care of the oppressed. Live by the golden rule, and I pray mercy. Disciples in this world are conduits. We are conduits of grace and peace and mercy. We are signposts of a different golden rule, a different way to see your neighbor. We acknowledge the power of God which sustains us and the grace of God with which we receive our daily bread. It is in this lowliness, this idea, this thought that as disciples that God gives us everything, that even our daily bread comes from God, that we can meet all people. That we're not better than anybody else, but we're just like everybody else. And here's the thing. When I get done with CVS and I want to get off the phone with the adjuster and I have a conversation with someone, and they tell me, is that how you're supposed to act? I have to walk back into CVS and look at the lady at the counter and say, I don't know who that person was that just got a passport photo. But this person wants to tell you that that person was a jerk and he's sorry. And then after I go through the damage report of being on the phone with the adjuster, because, you know, if you can't see someone, you can tell them whatever you want to. I've got to call back that phone number. Kind of hoping he doesn't answer the phone. You know, when you have a phone number, you're just hoping it's like someone else. He answers it. And I have to say, hey, man, I just talked to you about 30 minutes ago. Do you remember me? And it's bad when he says yes. Let me repeat. I don't know the guy you were just talking to on the other line. But this guy needs to tell you for that guy, he's sorry. Because that guy he didn't recognize. And it's always interesting when this happened. Because on the other end, he says, well, what else do you want? It's amazing how in apology we say that, right? As if I'm trying to get something. What else do you want? I go, nothing. I just need to recognize and tell you, and I said this, that I'm not better than you. And I understand you're doing what you're doing. And so I just need to call and say I'm sorry. His last thing was, no one does this. And I was like, well, I felt like I needed to. It's not to make me look better. It's to make us realize, first off, no one does this. Because when we live in a world of I'm better than you, we tend to surround ourselves with people who tell you good job, and we need to surround ourselves with people like Daniel, who will tell us, I know you feel superior, but you are very inferior. You're very much like the person on the other end of the line, and you're very much like the lady. And by the way, they showed you more grace than you showed them. And in Daniel 4, that's what we see. That we see that even in these moments in which we're brought low as we finish with Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel 4, that what we see is we see a pagan king who gives the Lord of heaven credit. We see a pagan king who gives the King of heaven all glory. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, for all his works are truth, all his ways are justice, and he is able to bring low those who walk in pride. That we don't see those moments with a CVS worker or those moments with an insurance adjuster as punishment, but what we see them is as a gift. As a gift from God to remind us of just who we are. As a gift of God to remind us that we are not better than everyone we talk to, but we are so much like everyone we talk to. And in those moments, I hope and pray that in your life as well, that you let God's grace work in you to remind you of that, that you can say you're sorry when you need to say you're sorry, and you can begin in your life, in this world, in a crazy world that feels like everything is flipped on its head and everyone's trying to get the next thing and get the next piece of gold so they can be better, so that they can flaunt it, that instead you can live by the words of Jesus. I tell you, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind. And love your neighbor as yourself. Both these two laws do the law and the prophets hang on. I don't think it was a suggestion from Jesus to his disciples in a world gone mad that you should live counter to that madness. It's hard and it's difficult and it's not fun. It's difficult to think you're better and think you're superior and find out you're not. But what it does do is help remind you that God is actively at work reminding us and informing us and making us more into his likeness so that we can talk to people with his words and see people through his eyes. Because I can tell you what, in 2 weeks, I didn't see two people through the eyes of Jesus. And that hurt. That really hurt. And all I can do is hope and pray that I can do it better tomorrow. Right? And pray we're not like Nebuchadnezzar. And 12 months later, we're back to square one. But we're always fighting in this world the golden rule of Jafar and the golden rule of Jesus. And Daniel shows us what it looks like to embody the golden rule of Jesus. Nebuchadnezzar shows us what it looks like to embody the golden rule of Jafar. And that's that tension we live as disciples in this world. If you have a need this morning, if you're going through something, if you're struggling with stuff, if you find yourself doing things and just say, hey, I need to apologize for something, we're here, you can talk to. Elders will be down front. People are next to you. They'll pray with you. But come now as we stand and as we sing.